Through Other Eyes by Rathira. Read by Rose as Madeline, Kess as Lucky, the 24th Key as Ket, Katie Hart as the Lady Aisling, and Something Incorporeal as Overseer Garrett. This is a Dishonored multi-voice podfic, with the pairing of Corvo Atano / The Outsider. Summary. The new Empress's Lord Protector has a lover. This is not a secret. There are many who wish it was.
Madeline's worked in the tower for nearly 5 years. She's seen more than her fair share of goings-on, upstairs and downstairs, thank you very much. And that was before the Empress was killed. More peaceful under Empress Jessamine. But there'd still been plenty of happenings. Not that Madeline'd ever tell of them. She's got a reputation these days, and it's one of unusual discretion. Something to be proud of, and it certainly let her keep her tongue and head and position when Hiram Burrows was in charge. Every resident in the tower knows that if you want your sheets changed without anyone else knowing, Madeline's the one to ask. It earns her a healthy bonus, and doesn't she need it with a mother, grandfather, and 2 nephews to look after? Plague didn't spare her brother, and Outsider only knows where their mother took herself off to. She doesn't think the Outsider's name too loudly. Empress Emily is a little more lax in following every man's strictures, but that doesn't mean the Abbey isn't watching. One day, Madeline's sure, she'll slip up. All that said and done, Madeline still can't help noticing. Lord Protector Corvo had never struck her before as any particular sort of man. He'd been quite nice, really. The Empress's lover, they all said, and looked to Madeline to tell. But, well, if she knew, that was one secret that Madeline would never even think about. But that was before he was taken to Coldridge, and before they'd put him to irons and fire and... Madeline didn't like to think about it. He smiles at her in the corridors. He smiles to their new empress, his daughter, so they say, little Emily Caldwin. And who's to prove yes or no? But they do say he wears a mask sometimes. That he was the masked man who roamed the streets those few terrifying weeks. The masked man who tore down the empire that Hiram Burrows made for himself. Madeline doesn't know about that. She does know that when she changes his sheets, they're often soaking wet, like he's put them in the bath, which would be strange enough, except the water's never soaked through to the bed beneath. Once she stripped them off, thick, oily fluid came off with them, viscous and blue, and it left her hands stained for days afterwards. It hadn't come off no matter how much she scrubbed. She'd had to wear gloves until it suddenly faded, and hadn't liked to touch anything much till it had. She doesn't talk about it to the other maids. But when her mother suggests they leave Dunwall, Madeline leaps at the chance.
The thing is, he's never been very lucky. His mum always coos and laughs whenever anyone mentions it, but Lucky really and truly feels it. It's like a joke. A big joke played on him, always. He's currently sandwiched between 2 bookshelves, trying not to breathe. The Lord Protector just entered the library. He's not alone. Lucky can't tell who he's with, but, well, it's pretty damn obvious he's not alone. The noises are... they're certainly happening. The Lord Protector can't talk anymore, but he can apparently make really... Lucky covers his ears. He can still hear the squelching. It seems weirdly loud. And much. And for some reason he can hear whale song too, really loud, and it's not like he's unfamiliar with whale song because Dar was a whaler before he was a hatter and before he was dead, and he used to take Lucky out to sea sometimes. Lucky still has nightmares about the whales. their big round black eyes so sad and mournful, and their singing that just won't stop. The singing is actually worse than the other noises. Lucky has to cover his nose and mouth, and even then he can feel bile clawing up his throat, practically taste the whale oil in the air. Thunder rolls outside, and he can hear a voice in his head and in his ears, and it sounds like a whale song, screaming as it utters the name. Corvo. The head librarian reprimands him for vomiting in the stacks later, and sends him home because he looks contagious. Lucky never goes back.
Cat doesn't think he knows they're there. Fair enough, really. Most people don't know Cat's there, and that's the way Cat likes it. But the dogs know he's there, and what the dogs know, Cat knows. On account of how all the dogs started whining and growling, and Fair woke Cat up, and it'll be hell to get him all back to sleep now. Retta snaps when Cat touches her. She's always been a bit jumpy, though, and she whines right proper a second or two later, ears slick back against her head. All the dogs huddle back against the kennel mesh, eyes big and teeth bared. Spines curved round so tight as to put their tails all the way up between their front legs. Except for Stumpy, and him only because his tail'd been bit clean off when he was a pup. Cat hushes at them, and eases open the kennel door. Ain't too light out yet, and the door doesn't creak on its hinges for once. Del snarls as Cat slips out, and is immediately snapped at by the rest of the pack. Him what's disturbed them doesn't seem to notice. There's talk instead. It rings weirdly in the kennels, bouncing strangely off the tin and wire mesh. Doesn't sound quite right. The dogs shudder all over. Cat keeps to all fours as they approach, close to the ground, easing along like a pup desperate for that last little sneak of milk. Cat's always been good at dog language. They freeze on all fours when he laughs, something about it echoing oddly. Shadows in the sky look weird too. Ain't too light out yet, but shouldn't be light out at all, by Cat's reckoning. Something strange going on here. Not too many people around the kennels anyhow, and him... Him as is what is not alone, that's what. Cat recognizes him, more's the pity. He's a knob, right fancy, proper high up. Cat keeps hidden behind the bins, but they know that coat. Mr. Corvo. He's not so bad for a knob. Not so bad. Not the one doing the talking, though. It's the other one Cat's not so sure on. Never seen him before, and Cat'd know him by sight and smell, and more things besides. All the hairs on Cat's arms and legs are standing up just to look at him. No wonders the dogs were scared. Even old Whaler, bless his bones, would have paused when faced with him. He leans down and kisses Mr. Corvo. The dogs are whining, and Cat can taste something sharp and iron in the air. Mr. Corvo looks like the dogs used to do when the overseers came round and put stuff in their food. Foaming at the mouth, and as like to kill themselves as each other, but blissed on it. Old Whaler had gone out that way. He looks just the same somehow. Blissed on it too, Cat thinks, but there's a storm in the air now, sharp as knives. My dear Corvo, he says, and Cat shudders to hear his voice. Cat creeps back to the kennel and huddles down amongst the dogs. His voice still rattles round their head. It will until they die.
The Lady Aisling never speaks about what she saw that night in the Tower of Dunwall. She does, however, write it down immediately upon taking permanent residence at the summer house in Cerconos. She knows she can never return to Dunwall, nor even to Gristle. Her memoirs are found some years later and mistaken for fiction. They will become something of a bestseller in certain circles. She doesn't bother with setting the scene or anything like that. Even naming her characters is too much effort for her. The god, she writes, approaches the man as boy and beast both. He is smooth-faced and young, and could almost be mistaken for any little lordling save for the terrible eyes set in his face. I cannot describe them. They are hideous beyond description. To look upon them was to have your very soul struck from your body. She continues. The man kept his eyes averted in obeisance. And in this it must be said that the Lady Aisling could not have been more wrong. But then she had been ill-equipped to parse what she was seeing. Her prose faltered as she attempted to describe the god's other form. Many-eyed and many-mouthed, she began, like a whale. I could not breathe in his presence. The god was larger than the room we stood in, and yet it contained all of his immense size. The man laid his bare and naked hands on that immense flank, and at the same time all he touched was the god's clothed waist. And it was as if eternity stretched between us and them. How shall I describe the movement of those bodies? The god's clothes melted away, dripping to the floor with whale oil splashes, and his beast form twisted. I feared I should be speared on its barbells or knocked aside by its might fluke, and the man laughed and seemed as if not to care. Perhaps he was truly mad to touch a god so irreverently, but... Her initial account ends there. The rest is lost beneath splattered blue ink, which many consider strange given that she began writing in black. The last legible words, written in a clearly different hand, simply read, "He would not approve, my dear," and are scrawled elegantly on the final page of that first book.
Garrett's been wandering the tower's corridors for months now. Every time he returns to the abbey empty-handed, they send him back to search again. "You will find proof," they say. "It is there to be found." How many other overseers have they said that to? How many other overseers does the heretic protector allow to search for proof of his blasphemy? They haven't told Garrett. And Garrett doesn't ask. He doesn't actually see many people at all in his day-to-day roaming. Several times he stumbled across the heretic protector, but the man does nothing more than smile at him. It's unnerving. It feels like he can see through Garrett's mask, through Garrett's face, and into all the thoughts underneath. He hasn't seen a single shrine or bone charm. No one so much as mentioned that name in his presence. It's possible, Garrett thinks, that this is a huge waste of time. Also, he is lost. Again. Garrett sighs, and absolutely does not pull his mask up and scrub a hand over his face in resignation. And if he did do such a thing, he would not have suddenly frozen upon suddenly hearing a creak from behind a nearby door. Silence reigns for a few seconds. And then there is another creak. As if someone's leaning on a table. There can't be anyone in there. Garrett's been up and down this hallway 5 times in the last hour. He was just in that room. There wasn't anyone in there. He would have noticed. Garrett takes a tentative step forward, and the whole world seems to tilt under his feet. He has never been to sea before, but Garrett is suddenly and violently seasick. His mask is already half off, and it is easy to throw it the rest of the way off, just in time for him to lose his breakfast. Garrett watches, in mild horror, as both the mask and breakfast float towards the ceiling. The door is painted blue and gold. Dark shadows seem to be creeping out from underneath it. Garrett can hear, unpleasantly, the obscene noises of someone breaking the sixth stricture. There is a tortured, startled sob. It sounds awful. Like dying. Vaguely, Garrett thinks this is probably the proof the Abbey's been looking for. He opens the door.
This has been Through Other Eyes, by Rathira. Read by Rose as Madeline, Kes as Lucky, the 24th Key as Ket, Katie Hart as the Lady Aisling, and Something Incorporeal as Overseer Garrett. The music in this podfic is Glittering Array by Ketsa. You can download this track, as well as the whole album, which I highly recommend, at the post for this podfic. I hope you enjoyed listening. Thank you.
you.